If Dale Peck is the most reviled book critic in America, James Wood is probably the most admired. His long essays on contemporary fiction are required reading for many book lovers. He's collected some of his essays in a book called The Irresponsible Self. Ironically, it was James Wood who first brought Peck to the attention of his editor at the New Republic. Wood told Steve Paulson he's not really bothered by Peck's spitefulness, but he says there is a problem with Peck's reviews.
In particular, I think they probably start out too savagely and too brutally. So that, I mean, there's a formal thing, which is if you start out that loudly, how are you going to get soft enough again so that you can start building up your volume, you know, towards the end of the piece? How do you make an argument when you start a piece with something that flagrantly isn't an argument? That's a real problem.
So by starting a piece, Rick Moody is the worst writer of his generation. Where do you go from there?
Yeah, you've vacated argument. That's the difficulty. And I say that as one who likes to start pieces myself with a bit of a bang, as you know well. So there's that difficulty. And I think, obviously, secondly, you run the risk of alienating readers. And where I'd also differ with Peck is that I probably agree with him in some respects about contemporary literature, but I think he doesn't do his own cause any good by sort of trashing then, you know, scores of writers from the 20th and indeed the 19th century. It's preposterous to start throwing Joyce and Nabokov and Faulkner and so on into the water. That doesn't make any sense to me, and I'm not inclined to do that because I like those writers.
What do you see as the job of a good literary critic?
Well, there's a definition that T.S. Eliot gave a long time ago which doesn't seem too bad to me, which is to elucidate texts and correct taste. Now, that sounds rather severe, particularly the correcting taste. But if you think about the two things, there's a primary task, particularly in longer pieces, which is to render things visible and coherent for readers. And there's this question of the correction of taste. If we soften that sense of correction and simply replace it with something like the education of taste, then that seems to me an important second part of the critic's job. That's why, you know, for instance, in my new book, I have a long thing against Tom Wolfe. It's quite spiteful in a way. It's a review of A Man in Full. But the aim is not spite. The aim actually is to serve the reader. It's to say, now look, you are being sold this book by certain other reviewers as a contemporary Dickens. This is the way in which you're being shortchanged. You can do better than this. I can show you how not only Dickens is better, but that other contemporary writers are better too. Richer, deeper, more patient, even smarter. So that's an important other part of the critic's role, and I think it's wrong that people are now hung up on this idea of spite. We get into this difficulty because we think too often that reviews are reviews written to the author of the books. They're not. They're written to the reader, in a sense, over the author's head. Authors naturally will read their reviews, but it's not clear to me that they should necessarily.
Your essay, Hysterical Realism, got a lot of attention when it first came out. Can you explain what you mean by this phrase, hysterical realism?
Yeah. I was bundling together a number of recent novels, Don DeLillo's Underworld, Thomas Pynchon's Mason and Dixon, Salman Rushdie's novel Fury, and The Ground Beneath Her Feet. And the actual occasion was a review of Zadie Smith's novel White Teeth. And it occurred to me that in all those novels you had fantastical happenings which weren't quite magic realist. They would be things like, the other novel was David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest. They would be things like a Canadian terrorist group who goes around in wheelchairs, a talking dog, a huge octagonal cheese. From Don DeLillo's novel, a nun who goes by the name of J. Edgar Hoover, and so on. It seemed like a progression on from magic realism. And yet it wasn't exactly that, as in magic realism, we were being seduced to believe impossible things. It seemed instead the problem was a sort of profusion of zany, crazy storytelling with the aim always to create a sort of greater vivacity, a greater liveliness, which I felt didn't really succeed.
Well, and I think it was another one of your essays, you say that in much of contemporary fiction, information has become the new character, that the human characters themselves are often not that recognizable in a lot of the most celebrated novels, but these writers who are very talented often go off in what would seem to be rather obscure tangents. I mean, passages on how to make the best Indian fish curry or the sonics of the trombone, the drug market in Detroit. I mean, they become experts in these obscure little things. They stuff them in their novels. And I mean, it is fun to read that. It is fun.
But it's interesting again, isn't it, that, you know, the moment, the precise moment in history when knowledge has never been easier to acquire. I mean, we're all instant experts, thanks to Google. Knowledge seems to be immensely prized, again, by certain reviewers about certain novels. The mere sort of possession of information. I mean, if you look at the way these novels are received, it seems to satisfy people simply to learn strange things that they didn't know before. Now, I've got nothing against that. I would seem very stick-in-the-muddish if I didn't want people to learn new things from fiction. Of course, fiction has to do with information. But it seems to me that, first of all, we shouldn't overprize it. I mean, information, knowledge, facts always have to take their place in the general structure of a novel. I mean, think, for instance, in Henry James, how little actual fact we're given socially, and yet how much we learn about a society. But the second thing is, I don't think we should overprize knowledge at a time when, as I say, it's never been easier to acquire. We shouldn't go around praising novelists for knowing a great deal when, say, 100 years ago, in order to know a great deal about other lands, you actually had to travel to them.
But one thing I'm curious about is, I mean, these writers you've mentioned, Salman Rushdie, Thomas Pynchon, Don DeLillo, David Foster Wallace, I mean, these are very talented writers. Why do they have so much reluctance to create rounded human beings?
Well, I think that's the other thing to say is that if we're talking generally about hysterical realism or whatever you want to call it, this zaniness, this noisy kind of comedy, I think one element of it is that it is a response to a crisis of characterization. And there's no doubt that if you look over the 20th century, it's become increasingly harder for writers to create character. And there have been various responses. I mean, parody is one kind of response. Postmodern self-consciousness, whereby the novelist is continually telling us, well, these are created characters, created by the writer, don't expect them to be deeper than they are on the page, is another. And you might say that magical realism and hysterical realism is yet another response. It's interesting to me because it's a way in which these novelists clearly signal that they are interested in the human, but they're not quite able, it seems to me, to drag out of the human that kind of eternal humanity that we go to some of the older great novelists for, and that's intensely interesting to me.
That's James Wood, literary critic at The New Republic. His new collection of essays is called The Irresponsible Self. He talked to Steve Paulson.